Welcome to the Forging Honor podcast. I'm Jonathan George.
And I'm Benjamin Jones. Here at Forging Honor, we explore what it means to live as Christian men. Along the way, we'll be doing challenges, building habits and character through action.
In today's episode, Banjo and I discuss how far is too far, and when we're talking about this technology, how the medium is the message, and then we talk about addiction and creativity. We hope you enjoy it. Hey, everybody. Just a quick show note from Jonathan here, or JJ. Wanted to let you know that we are coming in late with this episode. We're not actually exactly sure how late we'll be putting this out. We're recording a week later than we had originally planned to. Ran into some hardware as well as software issues as I was traveling over the week. So completely on me. But this is actually a re-record of our challenge wrap-up that we tried to do last week. We lost some audio. Not going to go into it. Anyway, so today's conversation, hopefully we'll make up for it. We're going to go a little bit longer. I've got a few more resources that I forgot to mention last time anyway, so I'll get to mention those. And hopefully it will be a good time. As far as general scheduling goes, after this week, we'll be back on with our regular schedule, and we'll be going into a new challenge next week. Awesome. Now on to the show. All right, it is challenge check-in time. As a reminder, challenges last for 6 weeks. That's a total of 42 days. They are simple daily tasks to grow us as Christian men. And the current challenge, the one we are wrapping up today, is to turn your phone completely off for 1 hour every day. Banjo, welcome back. How did the challenge go for you?
Went well. I think I have probably said this before in the last couple of weeks we're recording, but I've really appreciated this challenge. I really liked how tangible it was, even more so, I think, in some ways than some of our previous episodes. Have just kind of appreciated, a tangible effect. As we've mentioned earlier, we're coming in a little bit later than our regular record. We're technically past our deadline for the last challenge, but I feel like it's worth pointing out or worth noting. I think I've generally kept with the at least an hour with the phone off every day since we've finished the wrap up. So going on some extra time here, which I think speaks to this was a good challenge, at least for me. It was worth getting into. It's been good. I feel still that there's like other areas where I can improve, where I can keep taking the things I've learned here and kind of pushing it into some other territories, and kind of working on developing a healthier relationship with some of the other tech around the house. But so far, I think this is a really good start. JJ, how about you? How are you feeling at the end of this one?
I have felt really good. It is interesting having the extra week from when we thought we had ended this challenge to
right.
Then the realization partway through the week that we didn't have the audio to now. And in that time, reflecting on, all right, in the week where I didn't think about the challenge, how was my interaction with tech? And on the one hand, I've been pleased that for the most part, I've kind of kept with it. On the other hand, I did end up pulling my smartphone back out. So for me, there were kind of two aspects to this. There was the main aspect of like actually turning my phone off for 1 hour every day. I'm still checking that box. But I did end up pulling my smartphone back out partway through last week just because I was traveling and it got to the point where there were a few things I just had to use the smartphone for. So that was interesting to think about. And it kind of felt like a bit of a personal letdown. Like I'd only gone, I guess it was a total of like 4 or 5 weeks maybe of the dumb phone. We interviewed John McCollum after the first week. So, and it was right after that I did it. So it was 5 weeks. And so there's a little bit there that I thought was interesting and I think is worth discussing. But kind of going into the wrap up for today, one of the things that we talked about or that I would like to talk about, kind of is the question of how far is too far to go with these things? Because I went pretty extreme as far as like doing the full dumb phone, and working to cut a lot there. So the question I'm posing is like, how far is too far with trying to cut technology? Does it get to the point where, in an effort to not be distracted by technology, we're actually thinking about our tech use too much? So that's the question I'm posing to you, Banjo. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a good question, and one that I've kind of been, it's been bothering me a little bit in the last few weeks of the challenge. My tendency is to maybe be a little bit too anti-tech, or maybe I romanticize like, well, if we didn't have any of this technology, life would be better. I don't know that that's necessarily true, and I think that's probably going too far. Like one thing we definitely don't want to say is like that technology is in and of itself like bad, right? Like there's all this technology that's coming out. You know, we get the Vision Pro that's on its way to, you know, that's like the first step in some of this new VR technology that we have, which if you're into that kind of thing, is super cool. And if you're not, it's like, why do we have this? And all that to say that the technology itself is not bad, and we don't want to like take that stance, I don't think.
Well, it is interesting. One of the books, so first reference here, I think it was Digital Liturgies by Samuel D. James. He actually talks about a little bit how, and this gets to something you've been harping on a little bit with the medium is the message. About he doesn't like trying to say that technology is in fact neutral. He argues that technology is built with a purpose. Even if on a, so think about it this way, there's two sides to it. There is the physical components of the technology. Sure, that's neutral. Think of a shovel. Physical component there, you've got a stick of wood and a hunk of metal on the end. Nothing wrong with that. Okay. Now, what is the purpose that it's built for? The purpose of a shovel is to dig. Is that a good purpose? Okay. And I'm not going to get into debate about digging necessarily. But now take it to the smartphone. If the purpose, the physical components there, a combination of various minerals, metals, glass, etc., none of those individual parts are necessarily bad. They are affected by the fall in a way, but they're not like, those might be considered neutral. But the phone itself as a compounded technology, there's a telos built into that. There's a purpose built into that. So the argument is, if the maker of that device had a certain purpose in mind when they built it, then that device, while not morally culpable for anything itself, it might steer the user in a direction that is good or bad. That gets to the same debate as like the gun debate, right? The argument of, well, guns don't kill people, people kill people. That's one argument. The other argument is, well, the gun is literally made to kill people. Like that's what it's designed for.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So it's kind of the both and and same goes for the smartphone. Both are true. It is both, without a user, it just sits there. But as soon as you introduce a human being who wants to do something with it, that human being, it might necessarily be steered in a certain direction. So anyway, that was a bit of a sidetrack just to kind of...
I think that's an interesting point. And it's worth bringing up. I like what you're saying there of like, it's a both and. Like it is both kind of neutral in a sense, but there is the fact that we come to it and we're gonna do certain things with it.
Right.
And there are necessarily, probably we could say, speaking off the top of my head, there are necessarily proper ways to use a tool and perversions of that tool.
Right.
And we're never going to do just the one. It's probably worth acknowledging. Like, I'm probably going to use a pen for good and for evil. I can't think of a way that I could live a lifetime and only use the pen for good. Just because of my fallen nature. So but there is that element to it.
If you think about it, you know, when a pen is designed, it's designed for writing. It's very limiting in that factor. Like, yeah, you can talk about like the John Wick, you know, he killed a man with a pencil or whatever. Like, sure, you took it and used it for something other than what it was designed for. But if you're using it for how it's designed, you can make the argument that the actual action of writing, right? Like there's nothing, like the telos of the pen or the pencil, doesn't carry the same moral weight that the telos of a always connected device with social media on it or games or whatever else you have on there might carry. Does that make sense?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a fine distinction, and I don't want to get too bogged down in the philosophy of it just because I'm not sure that's quite the purposes of what we were doing with this discussion, but it gets a little bit to what Ben was talking about. Ben Skoon's earlier episode of this season, listener, if you haven't listened to it, go check it out. But you know, talking about the question of information and what even is information and can that carry a moral weight?
Right. Yeah. And I think it is worth pointing out there is something to that when we come to the phone. Like, we need to be aware that there is simply a simple technological aspect to it, which is to say, at some point it's just a device. You know, like at some point it's just designed for taking calls, just like the old rotary phones, just like the old 19th century weird. I don't even know how
the
to
big
describe
box
it. But
telephone on the wall, you mean?
Yeah, or like the one where you hold the receiver and the and the that one, yeah.
The big wooden box that you spoke into, yep, that you see in Andy right. Griffith. Yep.
Yeah, so it's some level, it's the same device. What is different about the phone, I think, is that there's this
or the smartphone
kind of
specifically,
or
right?
This, yeah, smartphone, we should say specifically, is that there is sort of a sandbox element to it that it just gets quickly filled up. Like there's a beauty to it that's kind of bewitching. You know, there's something that kind of sucks you into it. And I think as beautifully designed as a piece of technology as it is, I think that's actually the part that we have to be careful about. I bring that up, I guess, because I don't know if you've read, I've talked about this before, but have you read the Steve Jobs biography? I always forget.
No, I have not. You've mentioned it before, and I should. Of all the books I've read over the last 6 weeks, that was not one of them.
Yeah, it's a great read. If any of our listeners haven't read it, it's definitely worth picking up. A little bit of a slog. It's a long book, but it's endlessly fascinating. And one of the things I think that's fascinating about it is the way that Jobs was very intent on having this piece of technology that had a purpose, and he had some very specific ideas about what that purpose should be with the smartphone. But also that it should be something that's beautiful and should be something that is like desirable to look at and to hold, like every part of it, from the rounded edges to the way the apps look to the sounds that they make. It's all designed to be satisfying. And on the one hand, I think that's great. Like, I think that's like the way that we're supposed to approach life a little bit is to try and to do the best we can, you know, to, if we're going to give glory to God, in the things that we build, you know, there should be this element of like delighting in craftsmanship. I think that right. should be part of it. But I think what happened, and I don't want to valorize Steve Jobs too much, but I think that once he kind of stepped away, or once he died or passed away, I think the phone really got kind of taken over by people who were like, well, let's maximize the money from this thing. And at least reading the Walter Isaacson book, that didn't seem to be the main priority to Steve Jobs, at least in my reading of it. I could be wrong, but it's such a money-making device. It's such a thing that it grabs our attention so well. It really becomes Pandora's box after a while. And so to your point that like there is some design element to it that doesn't necessarily make it neutral, but at the same time, it is just a beautiful device.
Right.
And so all this to say, like we could play this game with any piece of technology that we have.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, but maybe if I can ask a question, why do you think it's so charged? What do you think the conversation gets so charged when we talk about, little pun there, when we talk about smartphones?
It's a good question. I think a lot of it is people are unaware to some extent about how much they've learned to love this piece of metal and glass. And how, like, even just the addictive nature of it. Like even when I have like my phone right now, my smartphone is trimmed back, no social media on it. I think it's got maybe 20 something apps total. Most of them are communication apps. Like I've got a bunch of different messaging apps. And then the rest, I've got my map apps. I've got some notes apps. And then of course the standard iOS, like your setting stuff, all those things. And then, some media consumption apps like podcasts, music. I have Blinkist, and my ESV Bible. And that pretty much sums it up. All right. I don't even have a browser on mine. And yet what I do is I go and I want to, you know, I go respond to a message that I get, and then I swipe back and forth and I look around and I scroll through some of my messages, and like, I'm not doing anything, but I just love looking at the screen. And I think, that's one of the reasons people get so worked up about this is they can't imagine, not being sucked into that screen. Now they wouldn't phrase it that way. You know, they phrase it as, right, well, I need to be connected, or I need to have instant communication for whatever reason.
I got to stay up to date.
Right, right. And you know, take it back to the rotary phone or the box phone on the wall. Like even that changed a lot of how people communicated, right? Because you saw once you had the ability to instantly communicate across vast distances, you know, people began to expect that and desire it. And we can't imagine a world without it now, right? The technology itself changed how we interact with other people. And I think every step along the way has just done that further, to the point where we get so worked up about this because we literally struggle to imagine a world without it. Like you might romanticize that world, but I'm not sure that even that romanticized view is even an accurate picture of what it's like, simply because both of us have grown up. I the smartphone was introduced probably when we were both in middle school era.
Yeah.
Early high school. Well, middle school. Anyway, smartphone introduced. And so for most of our lives, we have interacted with smartphones. We've been in a connected world.
Well, to that point, I kind of remember when my family first got a smartphone. And I remember as a child being mesmerized by this thing. It kind of reminds me of in The Lord of the Rings. We're going to get nerdy here for a second. But when Pippin looks into the Palantir, into the rock, that thing, for those who maybe are not as Tolkien nerdy as we are, in The Lord of the Rings, there's this this rock. I think it's supposed to be a star, part of a star, maybe.
No. There are questions about how it was forged. But it's
a magic
unknown
rock.
Material of some sort. Yeah, it's got some kind of magic where you can communicate with other people that hold these. They're like the smallest one is about the size of a little smaller than a basketball. The largest one was apparently like probably as large as a small Volkswagen Beetle.
But there were different sizes in Lord of the Rings.
Yep.
This is what people can communicate through these things, but they're also kind of, you got to be careful because you don't know who has another Palantir. And so at one point in the story, Pippin, who is a young hobbit, and very foolish because he's a Took, picks up the Palantir that the Fellowship has, that seems to be calling him, and he picks it up. And for a minute, he's kind of driven mad because he looks into the eye of Sauron, you know, into the bad guy's lair, basically. And it kind of drives him mad. And reading that, which is, of course, written in the late 20th century, no, early 20th century, before much of this technology exists, it's hard not to think of, at least for me, my first experiences with the iPhone, with this kind of technology, where it is kind of beautiful, it is kind of magic, and as soon as you see it, you kind of want to spend all your time there, because it's such a perfect version of the world. Do you know what I mean?
Right. Well, and here's the thing: in that analogy, the Palantir analogy, the reason, like in theory, the holder of the Palantir can see across the world, communicate with other holders of the Palantir. He's very free to do what he wants with it.
And it theoretically, he can use it for great good.
Exactly. And in fact, you know, in the history of the Numenoreans, they did. But the the catch is when there's a user who's more powerful on one end, they can kind of control how what the other Palantirs can see. They get to control.
Right.
It's what drives Denethor mad, because when he's looking into his Palantir, he's only able to see what Sauron allows him to see. So he's not even aware necessarily that Sauron's on the other end manipulating him in this way.
And but he thinks he's trying to see the future.
He thinks he's seeing the future, and he sees the fall of Gondor. Right. And he basically sees,
he's on Twitter.
Yeah. That's one way of thinking about it. But you know, there's a sense in which it's the same for us, where when we get on our smartphones, we're not actually free to do what we want. We're going to see what the designers of these things want us to see.
Right. There's a manipulation of our agency there.
Right. And that's where I say it's not simply a neutral device, because having a smartphone, when it sits there, it's receiving updates, notifications, there are changes happening there that are being affected by other people when I'm not using it. You know, if I leave my shovel out in the backyard, unless someone comes along and moves it, it's going to stay right there. Right. And not much is going to change about it. Obviously the elements can cause damage to it. But the smartphone, it's just silently sitting there, always updating, always listening.
And waking up even when we don't pick it up. I mean, if you've got something like notifications on, I mean, no other device in your house will do this. If any other device in your house did this, you'd freak out. It would be a poltergeist, basically.
Right. Some devices do now, because we've introduced smart devices into our homes.
It's true.
And it's a little bit like, I wonder about that. Is that a good thing to do in the long term? Like, there's a lot of questions I have, even beyond the moral, just about on the questions practical. Of privacy and security and just that side of things. Like, I'm not sure it's a good idea to just start jamming these things all around our house.
Yeah. One thing. So I just started reading recently, in my short story, wanderings, I've started reading stories by H.P. Lovecraft. Have you ever read any of his stories, JJ?
I have not. I should. I think you asked me. But I can't remember if this was on our initial attempt at recording this or if it was last episode.
Well, yes, I've never read, at least to my knowledge, I hadn't read any Lovecraft stories until recently. And I started reading them, and they're very entertaining. If you're into that kind of thing, but for anyone who doesn't know, like this kind of Lovecraftian horror is this cosmic horror where it's kind of a world of kind of what he calls the elder gods, which are these kind of like beasts and beings that have existed before time began, that kind of thing. And in Lovecraft's view of the world, basically, there are all these people who are constantly trying to wake up these elder gods. They're constantly given knowledge. They read a book of the occult, or they join a group or whatever it is, and they're constantly trying to wake up these elder gods. And it's really kind of a fascinating glimpse into human nature, I think, because as humans, we seem to do this all the time, where we just receive knowledge that is clearly above our pay grade, and we say, yeah, I want to go poke that bear. Like, I want to go wake up that thing. I want to go read this book that I'm not supposed to read. I want to dive into this world that we're not supposed to enter into. And it's to me, in the Lovecraft world, this is called the Necronomicon. And I've been thinking, like, this is the internet. Like, this is just this place where I'm not supposed to go. There's knowledge here that's too deep for me. I'm going to wake up something that is more dangerous than I can handle, but I'm going to do it anyway. And the thing in the Lovecraft world is like this knowledge is kind of constantly calling to you. It's kind of constantly dragging you into its clutches. And we could get into some Proverbs analogies there, I think, with the woman who calls in the street and that kind of thing, but from the doorway. But I do think there is this kind of, it's an interesting look into human nature. We seem to always run headlong into knowledge we don't understand.
It's really interesting to think about. I don't know if folks who are listening to the show have listened to the podcast Haunted Cosmos, I think I've mentioned it to you before, yeah, Banjo.
You've told me about it.
But they have an episode, it's one of the earlier episodes, on vampires. And then they also have an episode on like aliens and some of the evangelism that some of the folks in the alien community want to do about them. And they talk about the exact same thing in relation to the spiritual world. And basically with a giant warning of, look, there is something, probably demonic activity happening. Don't mess with it. Like, we're told explicitly in scripture to put to death the necromancers and to put to death the witches for a reason. Like, they're not just doing magic tricks. There's something happening there. And we're not supposed to mess with it. And not that the internet is necromancy, but you can take the same thing. And you know, they talk about in their vampires episode, like the woman Folly, the words used there are coming from some of the ancient myths of the Middle East. And Solomon uses some of those, that language of kind of the old understanding of vampires when he's talking about the woman Folly. So it's really fascinating that you made that connection. But that's the under the literary, the words that are being used in the Hebrew, it's exactly that that's being talked about the things and the sin that sucks the life out of you, which is what the vampire represents, right?
Yeah.
And in that sense, the internet has a lot of vampiric activity.
Right.
Right. I mean, I'm not saying that vampires are real, but the concept is what we're getting at here.
Well, right, and this is the thing about horror stories. Every horror story is some kind of projection of a culture's fears, of its kind of subconscious fears. And I think it is kind of worth noting. There's a lot of vampire movies that have come out recently. It's a genre with a resurgence lately, so it's worth pointing out. Anyway, I note all these things not because some people will say this. Some people, you know, will see a rise in those things and they'll talk about, you know, those are spiritual forces at work. I don't think that's necessarily the case, but I do think that they're interesting. It's an interesting way to keep a finger on the pulse of what is scaring a society. You know, where are the subconscious fears a little bit, and to see something like that popping up is interesting. And I think you're right that the internet has kind of this vampiric quality, this kind of suck the life out of you quality. And I think that's kind of old iconography. I mean, old for our generation. I mean, go back to the Matrix. You know, think about the Matrix as this. There's these fields and fields of these harvesting fields where, you know, Keanu Reeves is plugged into this machine that is literally sucking the life out of him. You know. It's always kind of been associated with this technology. There's a really good, I want to say it's a Philip K. Dick novel or a short story, but it might not be him, called, oh, I can't remember what it's called now. Something about a scream. But anyway, it's about human beings that are trapped in this computer. And the computer is like constantly creating new ways to torture them. To gain new data and to keep itself alive. And I think that's interesting. This is all a very negative, I think. There's a lot of negative connotations with kind of where we're going with these things. So I did want to ask before we get too far into the strange and macabre, JJ, as you've taken time to step away from your phone, as you have stepped away from the technology, have you been able to think of any ways that your phone has made you more creative or more connected? I'm asking because one of the ideas of the phone itself, I think, was that it was going to make people more creative. The smartphone was supposed to make people more artistic and give people time for that. Have you found that to be the case with yourself?
Yes and no. I'm not entirely sure if the phone itself has made me more creative or and kind of talking about creativity, I often will lump in kind of what like true productivity in there, along with craftsmanship, these general ideas, just because I'm not entirely sure the smartphone makes me more creative, but it can make me more truly productive. And when I'm right. when I say truly productive, I don't mean, oh, I got more emails done or I sent more texts today, right? Like, that's not what true productivity is. True productivity is accomplishing something that drives forward your goals or the goals of your employer or whatever it is. You're, you know, for if you're in the sense of your employer, true productivity is doing something that makes them money, right? In the sense of yourself, true productivity is accomplishing some goal that we have, which hopefully is under the broader goal of glorifying God. So, you know, a truly right. productive day around my house isn't, well, I sent a bunch of emails about this house project. It's actually accomplishing the projects, right? There's a lot of admin work that has to happen in order to get those projects done. So anyway, all that to say, I do think that technology can make us more truly productive, but it's much harder for us to discern what that true productivity is, or even harder for us to discern if we're actually being creative. You know, I might pull up GarageBand or, you know, one of these mini art apps or something. I don't ever do that, honestly. But my brother, for example, he very much uses a lot of the technology that exists to make music. And he makes very good music. And I think he is very creative. But a lot of that creativity isn't flowing from the app that he's using. It's flowing from the years of experience that he has gained in being taught music and learning music, in studying other forms of music, and in just kind of being saturated in that world. I will say, I think he's had more access to a variety of music. He's had the ability to learn more. And I would love to have a conversation with him about this now that I'm thinking about it. So in that sense, the connectedness of creatives is probably very helpful. You know, I love podcasts. It's one of the reasons we're doing a podcast.
Right.
And being able to hear other podcasts it drives the creativity. It drives forward the quality of this podcast, because I can say, oh, this other show's doing this, or this show does this, or they talk about it this way. Let's think about that. I don't know. It's kind of rambly, but there's a fine line between, yes, it's truly improving my life, and it's just adding more admin work somewhere in there. I don't know. Like, it's easy for me to get negative about all the admin I have to do,
right?
And about all the upkeep I have to do. But yeah, you're right. I think there is a sense where when I'm using it properly, I'm able to actually gain from this technology. I don't know. I'll have to think about a more succinct way to sum that up. But
well, it sounds like, to your point, you know, the GarageBand app can't make you more productive. I think I have this app that I haven't deleted yet because it amuses me from time to time. Tom Hanks, the movie star, put out he loves typewriters, apparently. This is one of his things. He loves typewriters. And so he helped develop an app that puts a typewriter on your smartphone. I mean, it's like it replaces your keyboard with a typewriter, basically. So you get like all of the noise and the clicks and the clacks and the dings and all that fun stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I downloaded it in college, and I would use that for kind of like any scrap ideas I had. And I would use it as a place of like, this doesn't count. I can write whatever I want here. Nobody's ever going to see it. And so if I have a first draft idea that I know is terrible, but I think it needs some work and it might turn into something, I would use that for it. And I enjoyed that space because it felt like a free space to think. And I didn't necessarily, but I could have done that with pen and paper, right? Like it didn't [S2] Right. [S1] Need to happen there. Or I think about the Notes app. I used to write a lot of things in the Notes app because I didn't carry a notebook, but since graduating from college, I just carry a notebook everywhere. And I find that that's generally more effective, I think. So, or at least for me. But it seems like the technology that comes with the phone, it can't make you more creative. There's no way it could do that, because the creativity can only come from a human being in that sense. Like that's the only way that can happen. But it can streamline that process, it seems. So
Right. Well, the streamlining and the ability to kind of mitigate some of the busy
remove
work.
Bumps in the road.
Exactly. Like, if you think about it, you know, if you wrote a first draft for a book, or you had a draft of a book and you wanted copies of it made, you had to send it off and someone had to retype all that up, or someone had to hand copy it out, something like that.
Huge advantage to use the computer there.
Exactly. I mean,
it's just unbelievably different.
And it's pretty incredible. And like you're saying, like, I have a notes app I love that it's very clean interface. And when I open it up, the way it's designed, it feels like, oh, I should start writing something when I open it up. And in that sense, it does drive me in the same way that a quality pen and paper is going to make you desire to use it more than a poor quality pen and paper, right?
Right.
And so I do think there is a sense in which, oh, the tools that we use help drive us towards certain things. So we could choose to use quality tools, right? Like, there's a reason I like Apple products, right? They look nice. They're clean. They're easy to use. I'm not overly distracted by the interface. Whereas when I use, you know, Windows or Android products, I get very quickly distracted by all the systems and settings. And like, that's fun to tinker with, but I'm not accomplishing anything by doing that.
Right.
And so in that sense, yeah, the best tool for the job, I think for a lot of jobs I do, is going to be a cleaner interface. But anyway.
Right. And that makes the most sense for you. At the same time, like, I think about Jerry Seinfeld, the comedian, has always, since the 70s and to this day, as far as I know, he writes all of his material with a yellow legal pad and a blue Bic pen. That's it. Never gets any fancier than that. And he's still killing it, you know? Well, you know, you could debate that, but in any event, like, at some point you just have to, like, do the work, I think. And I do wonder at this point in human history, how much we've gotten distracted by the technology and forgotten to do the craft work. That could just be me being cynical. But I think there are ways that the technology helps. And I think it is what you said. You talked about how your brother has these, he's got more access to things than ever before, and that's given him better knowledge. And I think that's actually the way that technology has helped me the most, is just giving me access to more things than I could possibly imagine.
Right.
Like the number of books that I've read online, the number of movies that I've been able to watch, TV shows, like the number of places where I've been able to pull ideas from has, you know, exponentially increased because of the internet. And that's hugely helpful. At the same time, though, I wonder how much time I've wasted looking for those things online. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly. I do think I want to look at this from another angle. In my world, developing software for other companies, one of the things that I've quickly learned is we don't just develop software because we think it'd be cool. We develop the software if it's going to make us more money, or if it's going to streamline some process so we can free a person up so they can do something else, right?
Right.
The whole goal from a business perspective with tech is simply make more money in some way. So we're not developing frivolously. Now, some companies do, but, you know, that's through poor management and poor leadership. But the companies that are doing it right are saying, we're going to build this app so that, you know, we can have more users, or we can have more people want to buy our product, et cetera. And I think, you know, you take that example and try to apply it to your personal life. You know, you're not trying to make more money with it, but whatever your personal life goals are, you want to do the same thing. You want to add tech to your life that accelerates you towards your goal, in a better way. And you don't want it. You don't want the cost of that either. Like, sure, maybe I have a goal of being being in the community, right? And I say, okay, Instagram is going to be great to help me be in a community more. Well, you could then, on the one hand, yes, you can technically connect to more people than you would have otherwise. However, what's the cost, right? There's a time and distraction side to it that I'm not sure it's worth that cost. In the same way, you know, if a business is developing an app, they're going to say, this would be really great. We could save, you know, $1,000 a week if we had this app, or we could make $1,000 more. But if it costs us several million dollars to develop, that's kind of not worth, like, those numbers don't math, right? And I think we can do the same thing with ourselves. And I would encourage people to do that and kind of take, like, if you have a family goal of going on more family outings, going to the park more with your kids, does having a shared family calendar actually accelerate you towards that goal, for example? Maybe yes, maybe no. I don't know. I think that's kind of what I'm getting at when I ask the question of like, when we're thinking about these things, how do we want to think about these things? And I think, I mean, a simple cost benefit really helps with that, which I mean, that kind of boils it down too much, and that abstracts away the moral side of it. So there's a few components to what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I think what one thing that's worth saying is like this area of technology, in some ways, I think it's so charged because everybody is using this differently, and everybody has to use it at a different level. And I think we're all kind of like vaguely aware that at some point we can all cross a line with technology. And maybe that's more clear now than ever before. Or maybe it's less clear. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe it's that it's less clear. Maybe in the past, if you had a printing press, say, and you were using that printing press to print, you know, terrible pornographic material, well, it was very clear, right? You're definitely sinning using that technology. Or you're using the printing press to print libel and slander or whichever the one is in print. And so that would be like a very clear violation of that technology. And maybe part of the problem is that the technology that we have access to now is a lot more nebulous in its in those lines. And maybe it's more difficult to get a clear sense of, well, that was a violation of my conscience, or that was a violation of somebody else's conscience. Like maybe that line has gotten muddier because of the way that the technology is designed. I'm not saying that's necessarily evil, but it is blurrier, and that would make it more difficult for us to know. Like maybe one person can post something on Twitter and feel that they have the moral imperative to do that. And if I see that tweet, I am offended because, you know, how could you say that? Or how could you think that was an edifying use of your keyboard and thumbs, that kind of a thing. Like maybe that's part of where these things get stickier. And then when we try and prescribe absolute rules about the internet, because it's so expansive, that it automatically rubs people the wrong way. That's just a hypothesis on the spur of the moment. I don't know if you've got thoughts on that.
It makes sense. I think the counter argument would be people have done this forever. You know, they have a thought and they blurt it out. And they anger everybody around them because what they said was stupid or enraging in some way.
True. And maybe it's the number of people that can get offended then. Maybe it's just the weight of it.
I'm not sure that causing offense should be our concern necessarily, because it's impossible to please everybody. However, I do think that certain networks, certain applications are more geared towards creating offensive and angry material, and that it's probably not personally edifying to utilize that. So take, for example, you know, Twitter used to have, back in the olden days, I think 140 character limit, and you don't have that same limit anymore if you pay for the premium plan or whatever. But in 140 characters, it's pretty difficult to give a well thought out constructed argument. So what does that mean? It means people are going to say quick, snappy things that draw a reaction. Okay. Now, a quick, snappy thing that draws a reaction isn't necessarily a bad thing. And I think it can be useful at times certainly entertaining. And it's useful at times if you want someone to pay attention to what you have to say something that's a little bit out, like, oh, they're saying that. I want to hear what they have to say more, because that was something. That was a take, right? And so, I mean, you see Paul do this at Mars Hill. He's like, so you have all these gods. Well, I know who the unknown god is that you have this altar to. And that's, you know, that's going to get a lot of Greeks' attention. They're like, oh, you know who the unknown god is?
I wouldn't say that's the same thing, though.
Maybe not.
Because that's more, what the setup there is long form. The setup there is he's studied the Greeks, he knows their situation, And he's engaging them on a level that's not, he's not seeking to offend them. He's saying, no. Hey, look, I noticed what you have over there. Let's talk about it. You know, you seem like you have some questions. I think I have some answers, you know? Well, so in a lot of ways that feels like the opposite of the online verse to me.
Well, I think it's, if anything, it's how it's done right. Cause he did offend some of them and, you know, some sure. way saying like, oh, he's crazy. And that's to be expected.
But that was because of the gospel.
Right.
He was,
right.
Well, they were offended because of that.
Right. And so that's where I say, like, I don't think our concern should be, oh, are we offending somebody? Because yeah, if I live by the gospel, I'm going to offend a lot of people. That said, I do think that when we intentionally are doing something simply to offend other people, there's the problem. So that gets back to the telos idea of like, or telos of like social media, where if social media is geared a certain way to where certain content bubbles up, you know, more people are interested in what makes them angry than what makes them happy, then that's what we're going to see more of. And that's not constructive. You know, it might be constructive if I walk into a room and my friends are doing something wrong, or, you know, if my son is doing something wrong, he's sinning in some way. For me, I shouldn't just quietly say, okay, hey, let's fix that. No, like, generally there's discipline there. Or if in the case of my friends, I might exclaim something like, you know, I might say something that catches their attention. Like, come on, like, don't be an idiot. And then kind of snap them out of it a little bit. And then, okay, now let's figure this out. But that's a both and, right? And I don't think, you know, Twitter doesn't allow for the both and. It only allows for the first part. So that's where, right. Like, I understand right. where some people are coming from when they say, oh, we do need to, we need to call out these people. I understand that. Like, I've heard that from Christians of, we do need the short, snappy things. And that's kind of the argument I was making earlier. But I would also add to your point with the purpose of adding that constructive thought later and causing people to actually want to hear what you have to say. Right.
Right. So yeah.
Does that make sense? There's a balance to it.
Totally. I think to add on to what you're saying, because I agree with what you're saying. Like, I would posit that, like, we're instructed in Scripture to give no offense but the gospel. Like, that's where the offense comes from, and that will be deeply disquieting to people to hear that there is no way that they can be saved except for faith in Jesus Christ. Well, you know, that there is no justification that they can bring before God except the blood of Christ. Like, that right. that will offend people.
Well, even take other gospel truths or Christian truths of, you know, we say, you and I believe that true marriage only occurs between a man and a woman before God, right? That is deeply offensive to a lot of people.
Right.
So
it is.
I might say that. I might tweet, oh, it's only marriage if it's between a man and a woman before God. If I leave it at that, I haven't presented the gospel. All I've done is I might have said something true that was also deeply offensive. That's fine on the one hand. But then if somebody comes back at me and is like, how can you possibly say that? And I just, you know, retort with equally fiery language, that's not moving the gospel forward in any way. I should come back with, you know, here's what the gospel has to say about it. Here's why I believe this, and have the long form argument on hand. Because otherwise all I'm doing is throwing things out there that, yes, might be true and are offensive, but I'm not edifying anybody by doing that.
Yeah. And I think it's worth pointing out that, if you look through the New Testament, you can see a lot of instances where Jesus, you know, says things that are, you know, cause a lot of offense or, you know, he's not afraid to throw a sarcastic comment, without sin. But who does he direct that to? He doesn't direct that to, people who are outside of the church. He doesn't direct that to people who are, or outside of the visible church, maybe we should say, but he directs it towards the Pharisees, the Sadducees, you know, to the religious leaders, to the hypocrites, to the ones who say that they are in the faith, but don't understand what he's saying, to the ones who say that, well, I know who God is. I worship him. But they don't recognize his son. That's where the bitter words go. That's where the woe to the scribes and the Pharisees go. But to the people who are outside of the visible church, he gives words of life. He gives words of comfort. And he doesn't, you know, that isn't to say that he says, oh, you know, go and do your sin. You know, that's the opposite of what he's saying. So I'm not saying that, but I think it's worth noting that it's really hard, or the best way to catch flies is with honey, you know, to put it maybe a little crassly. And that's not to say that we lie down and we compromise and we don't stand up for biblical truths. But I think that the place where Christians can do better on the internet, let me say it that way, the place where I think we can do better in the internet and be a light and a witness, is by choosing to use something that is maybe inherently designed for fire starting.
Right.
And to say, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to be different in this space. And I'm going to find a way to give the gospel, in all of its glory, and find a way to express as beautifully, as winsomely, as life-givingly as I can, that yes, I see your need as a sinner, but there is hope. I see your need as one who's outside of life, and here is good news for you. If we could make the internet like that, I mean, that'd be a world that I think I probably find hard to believe might exist on this side of paradise. But it's not worth striving for, I think. And so I think if we come away from this conversation about technology saying, yes, let's use it, but let's use it winsomely for the gospel, I think that's a good place to come away from. But it's certainly easier said than done.
Right. Well, I think there's a sense, a lot of that is just simply knowing your audience, knowing who you're gearing towards. Because like you said, you know, if Christ is saying some of the more offensive things to the Pharisees, another example would be, if you look at Christ's journeys through the Middle East during his ministry, you'll notice he talks about money the most when he's in the wealthiest portions of Israel. So when he's in Jerusalem, he talks about money to the wealthy people. When he's in Galilee among the hard workers and the fishermen who have nothing, he's giving more the encouragements of use your talents and grow what God has given you, right? So, and if you take those two messages, you might go, well, those seem contradictory. Well, no, he's speaking to two different audiences. And you kind of take that both hand in hand. So being aware of what kind of audience you are helps too. Like when you're selecting what content to listen to or to watch, knowing what kind of audience you are and where you are on your journey of sanctification really helps. I always appreciate when the podcasts I listen to tell me up front, this is for this kind of person. This is for the person who's already thought about some of these things. You know, some of the tech podcasts I listen to, this is for the developers out there, or this is for the people that are concerned about their use of technology. And then they jump into some ideas that wouldn't be helpful for someone that's only kind of just learning about some of this stuff, right? Or the same with some of the Christian podcasts I listen to. A lot of them would not be helpful for a non-Christian, period. And they're going to say things that would sound incredibly offensive to non-Christians and would not be helpful in any way to share the gospel necessarily. But they're very helpful for someone who's on their journey of sanctification as a Christian.
Sure.
And then there are other ones, other podcasts, or even sermons that I like to listen to that are much more geared towards the non-Christian, right? They're simply presenting the gospel. And yes, that'll cause some offense as well. But the difference being, like you're saying, it's the only offense being the gospel. So it's kind of be aware of what audience you're speaking to, and also be aware of the type of audience you are when you're choosing what to consume.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good note. As you're heading forward into the, you know, into our next challenge, whatever that may be, do you have any things from this challenge where you're like, okay, I'm definitely going to keep moving this forward. This was helpful. Are you going to expand it at all? Are you going to lay it aside? Are you going to, you know, you've got mm-hmm. You've got several different phones on the table, I imagine. Which one are you going to pick up?
So with the whole dumb phone thing, I not only do I have several phones figuratively to choose from, I literally have a variety of phones to use. A couple different dumb phones. I have a couple dumb phones, my smartphone, and then I have this one that's kind of like a weird in between. It's a dumb phone that's running a version of Android, so it has some of the smartphone features on a dumb phone platform. Pretty odd.
It's very nerdy.
Yeah. So I kind of got into this is again where I asked the question of like, did I go too far with thinking about this? Because I spent a lot of hours messing with these phones and trying to set them up how I wanted them and that kind of thing, doing some hackery. It was fun. I think what I so appreciated was when I wasn't using the smartphone, how undistracted I was. Like, I read so many books for this challenge that I haven't done for previous challenges. I got a lot more done around my house. Just, I wasn't distracted. I really, really, really liked that. On the other hand, it got really annoying when I had a part go out on my truck, and usually I just pull up my smartphone, you know, pull up a YouTube video, see what someone's doing, and then I know exactly what I need to do to fix it. I was running back and forth inside the house, watching this YouTube video, trying to get, you know, on my computer, going back and forth, going, okay, I need to connect this hose here, and do, you know, and it just got very frustrating.
It's inconvenient.
Right. And I don't think that purposely introducing certain inconveniences is actually all that useful. Because I ended up spending more time that day working on my truck than I would have otherwise. Right. So I would say there's a balance. I think probably what I'll end up doing is what I've done before and what I was sort of doing before this challenge, kind of the two phone scenario. So SIM swapping. So very practically, all SIM swapping is you have your SIM card. You need a physical one for this. You can't use the new eSIMs. But you take your SIM card, and on some days, maybe it's on my dumb phone. Other days, it's on my smartphone. That does have some inconveniences, but they're the inconveniences I'm choosing. So the inconvenience I choose when it's on my dumb phone is I don't have access to the quick lookup tools or the useful information that I might need. But I'm undistracted when I'm at work, or I'm undistracted when I'm with my family at the park.
Right.
But then I can swap that SIM, or I can turn on a hotspot on my dumb phone, pull up my smartphone, and have access to the things I need to have access to when I need them. But it's a much more conscious choice. So I think long term for me, what I'm taking away from this is I love the periods of no distraction. I really love the ability to make that conscious choice. I think it's a beautiful thing that I have the ability to do that. Completely cutting out the technology that enables me to accomplish certain things around the house, simply just at the end of the day, it just doesn't make sense.
So totally.
Does that answer that question well for you?
Yeah, I think that's a good note. It's like, just because something is inconvenient doesn't mean that it's good. That's probably a good motto to have handy when you're cutting technology. Yeah, I like that. I mean, for myself, this last month, I wrote out a piece on my typewriter, and I did most of my writing on my typewriter, and that was really great for like slowly thinking through a story and like really chewing on it, spending time on it, and I loved like watching like stacks of paper rise through this first draft of the story. Typewriter is like super inconvenient for editing. Like, it doesn't make any sense to do your editing nowadays on a typewriter. It's also kind of inconvenient to like, I have to transfer the story from the paper copy to the digital copy, which on the one hand is really nice because it gives me a chance to kind of edit as I go and forces me to do some editing that I might have skipped out on if I had started on the computer. But at the same time, I've gone back to do some short story writing, and I work much, much faster on the computer. It's just simpler. It's easier. I can produce a lot more on the computer, and there's pros and cons to that. And so I'm kind of, after a month of writing exclusively on the typewriter for creative purposes, trying to take some time to do some writing on my laptop. It's going to be an interesting shift. I'm curious to see kind of how that will, how the change will go. I don't think writing on one or the other necessarily makes me a better writer, just like I don't think writing with a Bic pen is any better than writing with a, you know, a Zebra pen or whatever. But I think there's going to be some interesting differences. So I'll let you know how that one goes.
I really like that though, the choosing of different technologies for different purposes, even if you're writing, like you're writing on both hands.
Yeah.
But you know, in one sense, when you're writing a typewriter, what you said about slowing down and having to really dwell on the story versus if you just want to kind of get through a short story idea really quickly, you had a different purpose in setting out. Right. It would be, I think, short-sighted to say your purpose was simply to write on both hand on both sides of that. You were setting out to write something differently when you did either of those activities. And I think the same could be said for any technology we choose. So I think if I was going to sum up what I've learned from this challenge, it would be, I think it's worth reclaiming that agency of choice, right? And choosing diligently what tool to use for what specific task. You know, when you have the right tool for a task, it's a lot easier. It's going to be a lot better. So choose the right tool. I would also say technology has so many addictive tendencies with social media, with online games, with pornography, etc. If it is an addiction for you, if YouTube Shorts is an addiction, cut it out. YouTube is not worth the amount of information on YouTube is simply not worth the amount of distraction and addiction that you're going to cause for yourself. It's the whole, if your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. And I think that is a good, for some people that might mean cutting out most technology and getting rid of their smartphone entirely. I think that's a good thing that we have the ability to do that. And I don't think that we should allow ourselves to simply go along with the narrative of everybody needs a smartphone. Because if we all do that, then we'll no longer have that agency of choice. So I would encourage everybody to go find a second phone and SIM swap or do something that allows you to maintain that choice or a typewriter or whatever it is, whatever your job or your life goals look like. Find that secondary option.
I can't remember if I said this or not already, so I'll mention it here. One of my favorite statistics when talking about this is that there are more people who have smartphones in the world than have access to working toilets. Even in third world or developing countries or whatever the right term for that is now, everybody has one of these smartphones, even at the cost of indoor plumbing. And I think that's a pretty good depiction of kind of where we're at in society with this kind of technology that has blossomed, run rampant as kudzu in South Georgia, you know, whatever imagery you want to use.
Right.
It's everywhere. And that's not, I think it's worth stating, that's not necessarily a bad thing. Like it's not necessarily 100% evil that we have these things. The thing that I would take away from this challenge to kind of go along with what you're saying, JJ, is like take every thought captive, you know, to kind of examine our daily life and to say, okay, is this technology that I'm using, is this website that I'm going to, is this show that I'm watching, is this something that is glorifying to the God and edifying to myself?
Right.
And of course, that's going to look different for every single person. There's going to be some basic similarities, but at the end of the day, you know, we're all going to have different things according to our consciences. And that's good. Like there's that good Christian liberty there. But is it glorifying to God and is it edifying to you? That's going to be the main question. I think along with that, it's worth thinking of what Paul says about, you know, whatever is true, whatever is good, whatever is honorable, whatever is noble, dwell on these things. And so if technology is a place where you're able to do that, if the internet, if social media is a place where you're able to do that, good for you. Like, keep going. Not everybody is able to do that. I'm certainly not able to do that as much as I would like. But then again, most of my book reading, I think probably some folks would consider unedifying and unhelpful. But again, personal taste. So that to say, I think it's it's got to be a conversation that is maybe that is wider than just technology.
Right.
What we're talking about here is ultimately we're not actually talking about technology. Ultimately, what we're talking about is human nature, and our tendency to take whatever's in front of us and turn it to sin, and turn it against God. And the good news is we're saved. The good news is we've been taken away from that. So now that Christ has, you know, died for us, has covered us with his blood, don't go back to the old ways. You know, don't go back to that old man, behavior. But the technology is out there. And I think that means, you know, that to quote, I think it's Kuiper, you know, there's not one square inch over this creation. And that includes technology, where Christ does not declare this is mine. You know, and so I think we can take great comfort and go forth with great boldness, being willing to offer the comfort and the offense that is the gospel of Jesus Christ. You know, so I think at the end of the day, that's probably what I will take away from this challenge.
Very good. On that note, what resources? I guess I can go first on this, but what resources?
You've got a lot more than I do this one.
Yes, I've been reading a good bit. So what resources would we recommend? I've already mentioned one this episode, Digital Liturgies by Samuel D. James, an excellent book. The subtitle of this is Rediscovering Christian Wisdom in an Online Age. Go check that out. And then a couple here that come from a little bit more of the technological perspective and might have some wording in here that might be geared more towards the computer science folks. But Shaping a Digital World, Faith, Culture, and Computer Technology by Derek C. Sherman. A good book if you're looking at how technology might shape us. And then From the Garden to the City by John Dyer. Also very good and approaches how we design technology. So both of those come a little bit more from if you're actively partaking in the design of this tech, good stuff to read. And then another book that came out not too long ago that a lot of folks have probably read is 12 Ways Your Phone is Changing You by Tony Reinke. That's a good one. It's more of an awareness book, like be aware of some of these things. And then one that I really appreciated, I'm not sure if he's a Christian or not, but Digital Minimalism by Cal Newport, his podcast on I think it's called The Deep Life or something, is also very good. Just talks about technology and how it either helps your goals or doesn't. And then one that we've both mentioned at various points in this podcast or the series, Banjo, is Neil Postman's Amusing Ourselves to Death. Great, great little book. You know, he's talking about television, but still applicable today. And then
more so than ever, I would say.
One more. That I didn't grab for this stack, and I can't remember the author of, but it's sitting on a shelf somewhere in my house, is The TechWise Family. And that one's good. If you are a family trying to implement some of these things, read through that. The author has some great ideas for how you as a family can work to implement better habits around your technology. I know there were other things we've mentioned throughout the series, but that's the stack of books. Banjo, did you have anything else to add?
Well, your library is better suited for this category than mine. I will toss out there. I've mentioned these resources before, but I think it's worth bringing up. David Foster Wallace is an American essayist from the 90s and early 2000s. A really, really kind of brilliant mind. And he's got some really good stuff on kind of American culture and kind of maybe broader brush topics. He's got a great essay speech thing called This Is Water. That's worth checking out. It's a great kind of a great place to start if you're thinking about how do I do some self-examination and kind of figure out the world that I'm swimming in. You'll get that reference if you read the essay. And another one that he wrote is E Unibus Plurum. And that's a really great essay that he writes about the way that TV culture changed America and the way that we kind of perceive ourselves and one another. Similar to amusing ourselves to death, but he focuses primarily on the concept of irony and that how that's kind of a really pervasive part of our culture and how that's not necessarily a good thing. So I think that's really worth checking out. And then, you know, go have some fun. Read an H.P. Lovecraft story. That's all yeah. I'll say.
Good stuff. I think other things you've mentioned previous episodes were Social Network, the movie that I have yet to watch.
Yes.
But apparently a good movie.
It's excellent. Par excellence. And also, then, the Steve Jobs book is worth a read.
Steve Jobs book. And then that documentary that we both mentioned that I can never remember the name of.
Social Dilemma.
Thank you, Banjo. The Social Dilemma. Excellent. I think that's on Netflix. So
yes,
you know, go Netflix. Pull up your app for that and watch that. Otherwise, yeah, there are tons of other resources we could mention and just don't have the time to. But yes, pick one or two of those. I would encourage anyone listening to this to pick one or two of those, give them a read, a watch, or a listen, and kind of start. I think just generally learning to be more aware of this, like you were saying, that's a great step in the right direction. Well, that wraps up today's challenge wrap up. If you didn't catch the earlier episodes in the season, go back, give them a listen, especially our interviews with John McCollum and Ben Skoons. Both of those were very helpful in helping us to think about these things and to put into action some of what we're talking about. So check those out. Otherwise, I really hope that you're able to take some of what we discussed and put it into practice. And we will see you next week.
This has been the Forging Honor podcast. Music and production is by Elliot George. For more information about what we do or to learn how to get involved, visit our website at forginghonor.com. There you'll find information about our community, The Forge, and how to join other young men seeking to glorify God in thought, word, and deed. You'll also find blog articles, book recommendations, and more ways to grow as a Christian man.
If you enjoyed the show, please tell a friend or family member about Forging Honor. We would also appreciate it if you would take a moment to like and subscribe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, a rating and review only takes a moment, and it goes a long way towards growing the Forging Honor community.
Thanks for taking the time with us today. We hope you'll take up the work alongside us and join us in the task of Forging Honor. We'll see you next time.